Yn gyntaf, diolch o galon am croesawu fi yma heddiw yma. Thank you so much for inviting me here today. Peter described me as a missionary down in London. Well, when I went to London, I started off going to a free church, a former Rictus church, for about 3 years. And for the past 3 years, I've been a part of an Anglican church. So you could kind of say I'm a Baptist free church Anglican missionary down in London working for Tear Fund. For those of you who don't know my background, I work for Tear Fund. I've been working for them for 3 years, and they're a Christian International Relief and Development Agency. And before that, I also used to work for Christian Aid as well. So just on that note about Christian Aid Week, it is a really worthwhile cause. So do support that if you can. My background is I'm a Bethesda boy originally. My dad's side of the family, my dad is over there, are local gypsy travellers. And my mum's side are proper Cymro Cymraeg from Carnarvon and from Rachib. So a bit of an eclectic mix that came into making me. And Penrath was the church I came to faith in about 7 years ago. I was doing a master's in international development at the time. Before that, I'd been president of the Students' Union here. And this is where I started my journey. And I titled the talk in your kind of little handbook says kind of growing into the new life. But I think actually I want to retitle that as walking the road of the new life instead. And that's where my particular journey started. Just one thing I want to say, which is really exciting for me, is when I came to faith, I was the only person really in my family who was a kind of a practicing Christian in my immediate surroundings in terms of how I understand faith now. But what I find really exciting is that since then, my mum and dad have started to come to church and come here to Penrath and have been involved in the Alpha Course. And I have to say that the Alpha Course is genius. The fact that you're offering free food has been like one of the main hooks that has got my dad involved. Whenever I've phoned up, I always kind of hear how amazing the lasagna is or the shepherd's pie. And he just can't stop talking about the puddings as well. So keep the strategy up. And I didn't realize it was a church lunch today. So that's, you know, that's perfect as well. So keep up the good work on that. And it is a bit like father, like son. Down in London, I have the nickname of Andy Two Lunches. Well, actually Andy Three Lunches now. He's passed on the trait of enjoying food. So do use that as a strategy to keep getting people into Penrath. So when I went down to London, the first job I had was working for Christian Aid, working on international campaigns. It was always a passion I had. It was why I became president of the Students' Union. I had a bit of a gob on me and I couldn't keep it shut. I had to speak out when I saw things I wasn't happy with. So I went down to London, started working on an international tax justice campaign. And then after about 3 years, I moved over to the Yellow Side and joined in with Tear Fund working on an anti-corruption campaign, and also helped last year with a campaign on global hunger called the IF campaign that some of you might have heard of and been aware of. Then in September last year, I got married to my lovely wife now, Flora. Flora, give us a wave. She's just over there on your right. She's a midwife as well, so it's great that you were praying for the amazing work of the NHS as well. It is incredible what we do now and how we're able to help people. Once we got married, we took a mini sabbatical. We went over to America for just shy of 2 months to visit some churches, because one of the things that's on my heart is thinking about maybe ordination into the Church of England, just seeing what lies ahead of us in terms of ministry. And it was also a great opportunity after getting married for me to kind of take a sabbatical out of working on international campaigning and to focus on UK poverty. It's something I've always had a big interest in. So since January this year, I have moved into the UK team in Tear Fund, which is called Impact UK. And it very much is focused on UK poverty. And when we talk about transitioning out of UK poverty, we are really talking about what is it we need to do in order to help individuals to flourish and communities to flourish. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about today, was about poverty and flourishing. Now, a few months ago, I came across a very small book called The Diadact. I found it actually on Kindle. It's amazing what you get for free on Kindle if you search through there. The Diadact is actually known as the Teachings. It was known as the Teachings of the Apostles. And they believe it came about in the early 2nd century. It was a kind of a manifesto of the early church. It was like a condensed version of the early teachings of the church. And it was something that was widely read and was widely available. And it almost got included in the book we now know as the Bible. It didn't make it into it, but it was always a highly respected document. And it's interesting, and what struck me was the opening sentence in that document, the manifesto of the early Christian church. It said this: "There are two paths, one of life and one of death, and the difference is great between the two. There are two paths, one of life and one of death, and the difference between the two is great." And we at TearFund essentially hold that same view. We believe that there are two paths. We believe there is a path and a road of death, which we encapsulate in the term of broken relationships, which is our ultimate understanding of poverty. And there is a way and there is a road of life, which we understand as restored relationships. And the video you saw earlier, which is our theory of poverty and how we change that situation, kind of encapsulates those two paths. For us in TearFund, poverty is not just about money, it's holistic. It's not just about the physical, it's also about the social, the environmental, and the spiritual. We understand through our 40-odd years of experience that poverty is complex and multifaceted. But we do believe passionately that the root cause of poverty is broken relationships, which entered this world as a result of humanity's rebellion against God, but also our rebellion against each other as well. And through that, we moved from a life of wholeness, of living in perfect relationships with God, with creation, with ourselves, and with our neighbours, into a life of broken relationships. We were cut off from God. We cut ourselves off from our neighbours. We cut ourselves off from our own understanding of who we truly are. And we cut ourselves off from the created environment. We started to believe a self-image which was wrong about ourselves. We started to lose a clear and true understanding of who we are. As TearFund, we believe the mission of the church is one of reconciliation and ultimately of restored relationships. And the outworking of this we call integral mission. And we believe the church's approach must be one that is holistic. Just as poverty is holistic, dealing with the whole needs of the whole person, the spiritual, the physical, the economic, the social, it is all together. It's holistic. We need to hold them together. And we believe if we as the church go into integral mission, that we will see relationships restored. And ultimately, relationships restored is kind of what we view as human flourishing, true flourishing and wholeness and thriving as life was meant to be. Now, this evening, I'm going to go into a bit more detail about what, as a community, we can do to live that out, how we can be an authentic community, and how we can take that understanding of human flourishing out into our communities. But this morning, I want to particularly focus on what does restored relationships mean for us as individuals right here, right now. What does it mean for us to flourish, to be the person, to grow up into the person that God had always made us to be, which is, in a way, the ultimate restored relationship with ourselves. And there's three points I want to bring out from the passages that Peter kindly read. One of the points is that there is a path which leads to death, that it is there, that we can't deny it. That the idea that the world is relative is actually not the case, that there are essentially two paths. There is a path that leads to death. The second point is but there is a way out of that. There is a path of life. And like newborn babies, we can grow up in our salvation. We can start that journey afresh. We can have a spiritual rebirth onto a new path. And then the final point I want to make is that the ultimate end of that journey of human flourishing is to die to self. It is to get to that point of complete vulnerability where we're able to be authentically who God has always made us to be. So the first point is that there is a path that leads to death, and we can be dead in our own ways. If you look at Scripture, if you look at 1 Peter 1:14, we see there, it says, "As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance." There is something about this path of death, which is about ignorance, is about not knowing. Now, whether that not knowing comes because of external factors or voluntary factors, it can be there. And a lot of the time, it can be down to our own choosing not to know. How many times when we see something that's uncomfortable, do we change the channel? Or if we hear something that is a bit too difficult to believe in, we choose to ignore it, or disbelief. How many times do we ignore scientists, or we ignore research, or we ignore other things? Because we actually prefer to live in the bubble of self-deception. We prefer to take that path of death because in that moment, it is more convenient for us. It is more comforting for us. The reality of the world actually can be too painful for us to want to hear the truth. And so we choose a path of ignorance and self-denial. But not only is it a path that we ourselves can choose to go down, a path of ignorance, there is an element of this which is passed down to us from previous generations and from the culture we're surrounded in. In 1 Peter 1:18, it says, "Be redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors." There is something about the life that we live where sometimes we don't know things because we were never told them, because the culture we live in never made them obvious to us, because there was a knowledge that was there previously that disappeared. It was something that our culture deemed to be worthless, so we chucked it away. And how much, really, in the culture that we're living in at the moment, a postmodern culture, a post-Christendom culture, how much of some of the truths that we think are self-evident about the Christian faith actually are already being jettisoned? How many people actually have very little knowledge of what true Christian faith is, who Jesus truly was, about what the journey of salvation truly is? And it's one of those things that we can see in cultures abroad sometimes more easily than we can see in ourselves. So one of the things that's been on the news has been about female genital mutilation. And then we can see there, wow, there's something culturally wrong there. There is something that's being handed down from generation to generation that is wrong, that is not life-giving, that is not loving, and we want to challenge that. But it is just as much in our Western culture of individualism as well. There is something about broken habits and addictions and behaviors which gets handed down from generation to generation. An example of this from the US, which I'm sure the research in the UK would reiterate. According to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, children who live with an alcoholic relative are at a far greater risk of having emotional problems than children who do not. And alcoholism runs in families. The research shows that children of alcoholics are 4 times more likely than other children to become alcoholics themselves. There is something about an empty way of life that is handed down to us. And we like to believe we're completely individualistic and that we make all of our own choices. But it's amazing how much we take on from our parents, from our families, from our cultures. And that is not necessarily always good. It can be negative as well. It made me think, actually. It opened up the Bible in a fresh way to me. If you have a chance to look at Exodus 34:7, it talks about how the guilty will not remain unpunished, and talking about how God punishes the children and their children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation. And I don't take that to mean that God just willfully punishes generations down from a person who commits a sin. But I take that to mean that when we do something which is ultimately damaging and broken, that brokenness, that kind of disease, is passed down from generation to generation. Unfortunately for us, there is a way out of that. But we have to acknowledge that the brokenness of society can go down from generation to generation to generation and can become part of the structure of our culture that we live in. So there is a road that leads to poverty, to broken relationships with ourselves, with God, and with our neighbours, and with the environment. But the second point I wanted to highlight is that there is a way out. There is another road. It is narrower. It is harder to find sometimes, but there is an alternative route. If you have a look at 1 Peter 1:23, he says, "For you have been born again, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable, through the living and enduring word of God." There is something about being born again, about a spiritual rebirth. It's about, when I came to faith, I described it as kind of seeing the world in black and white, and all of a sudden somebody switched it into color. And all of a sudden I could see things I couldn't see before. I was able to experience things I couldn't experience before. There was a softening of the heart. It was like my heart had a hard, crusty shell around it. And all of a sudden, like a pickaxe had just broken a little piece of that hardness off, and some of that light came in, and it was almost as I could see the path. It was there in front of me. I wasn't completely transformed, but there was something there. There was a rebirth that happened in my life. I remember the night I got baptized here. I went back up to, I was a warden in the Bangor University up in the halls, the Frithoes site, and I went back to my room and I laid in my bed and I couldn't sleep. I was completely awake all night. Completely, just as if I drunk about 5 cans of Red Bull. I was just laying there. And that was it. I knew something had happened that night. Another thing that had happened, and I'm slightly going off my script here, but another thing that happened is when I was a kid, and my mum would remember this, I used to get nightmares all the time. I don't know what it was. I remember the first ever nightmare I had, which was of like a bell ringing, a really loud bell. And I just couldn't sleep, and I wake up. And when I was, even as an early teenager, I'd always sleep with the covers over my head because there was just something in there. There was a fear. There was something of darkness in there. I couldn't even explain it. The night I came to faith, was the first night. That for me was the moment. Beyond that time, I didn't have any nightmares. I haven't had any nightmares since. I've had weird dreams. I tell you, I definitely had weird dreams since. But I haven't had any nightmares. And that's an incredible thing. There is a moment in time when a rebirth can happen, when something can change. And that is powerful. And I think also there's something in that as well about a rebirth in terms of our identity. When we come to faith, we're given a new identity. And actually, it's not really a new identity. It's an identity we always had, but we kind of forgot about. Because we've always been beloved children of God. We've always been made in his image. We've always been wonderfully made. I loved the psalm that was up, that was being quoted earlier, because I was hoping it was the same psalm, because this is kind of just kind of crossed my mind. But what I love about that psalm is if you carry on in that psalm, Psalm 139, if you go to verse 13 of that, it kind of says, "For you created my inmost being. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." That is your identity. Whatever you think about yourself, you are not the ultimate authority in deciding who you are. God is, because God is your creator. And he says, "You are fearfully and wonderfully made. You are cherished. You are beloved." And any journey needs to start with understanding who you really are. And that is the beginning of the journey of life, is really getting a hold of who you really, really are. You are a beloved child of God. It is not a new identity. It's an old one that we forgot. And in a sense, repentance, that turning around, that changing of your mind, that letting go of one thing to turn back to something else, is not a turning, in a sense, to something new. It's a turning back to something that was always there. That narrow road was always there. That identity was always there for us, but we forgot it. But as a child, when we come to that understanding, we need to come humbly. It goes on in 1 Peter chapter 2 to say, "Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk so that by it you may grow up into your salvation." Salvation is not a one-time event. Salvation is a journey and a process. When we come to faith, we come as newborn babies. We come completely new. We almost come like a blank slate. There is something about coming humbly to this new identity and this new journey we're offered. There's something about craving spiritual milk. Because we're new to it, we need to learn new skills. We need to learn new habits. We need to learn new ways of being in relationship with each other. Spiritual milk is praying with each other. It's reading the Bible. It's confessing sins and really confessing sins as well. Not just kind of saying, oh yeah, God, I'm sorry for being selfish or whatever. It's actually going, do you know what? That thing I did on Tuesday, actually, I'm sorry for that. That thought I had about that person, actually, yeah, I let go of that and I'm sorry. The way I hurt my wife, actually, I'm going to go and apologize to her. These are the spiritual practices. These are the spiritual kind of the ways of living. This is the spiritual food that will help us to grow in our salvation, to ultimately grow into the image of Jesus himself. And there's something about that journey which is particularly important for us as a church to be aware of as well. And this is something that I'll focus on much more tonight. But for us to grow into that new identity, we need to be part of authentic communities. I'll just say this about some research they did in America, two different findings. An American researcher, Anne Breiling, studying how students grow in their faith, concluded that a student's faith is most impacted by being in an authentic relationship with a godly teacher, coach, parent, or adult. Another piece of research was just slightly independent. It was by a group of Christian counselors in California as part of a center called Shepherd's House. Through 25 years of experience, they concluded that people heal and are restored in authentic, God-centered relationships and families, and that people without these resources recover much more slowly, if at all. The journey of healing, whatever hurts we might have when we come to faith, the journey of growing in that faith, they are saying that if it is possible at all, it's going to be difficult without authentic relationships, and yet they actually see that the evidence seems to point that without a place where you can be yourself, where you can be safe, where you can be vulnerable, that actually that journey of growth is virtually impossible. So it is not a lone journey. It is a journey that we take together to grow. So as a church, everything we must do must be about formulating authentic, safe, and grace-filled relationships. Relationships marked by kindness, forgiveness, non-judgmentalism, generosity, and then truth. How many times in a church do we want to focus on scriptural truth without being that loving, safe place first? And the third and final point I want to make from the scriptures is that the end of this journey of human flourishing, the walking the narrow path, is a journey to die to self, to become completely vulnerable. And this is in why I wanted the passage from John 15. If you turn to John 15, it's on, I'll read just a little section from this, from verse 12. My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friend. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friend. That's a biggie. That's going to hurt. That's painful. But this is something we shouldn't rush into, or shouldn't even think we have to rush into. I've only been a Christian 7 years, but I'll tell you one thing, it's really opened my eyes when you read the scriptures and you realize that those early followers of Jesus, even they didn't get it straight away. They were following Jesus for 3 years, and yet on the night that Jesus was crucified, Peter was willing to deny him 3 times. That Paul, who became, you know, the greatest of preachers and evangelists and apostles to the people who were not Jewish, he had 3 years disappeared somewhere where he was reflecting on the amazing moment he'd had when he'd experienced the love of Jesus. He had 3 years of kind of coming to terms with that, to growing, to learning. This is not a thing where we should expect overnight that we become these new people, but it is a journey and there's a process. And as we grow, we are called to grow more and more into that place of vulnerability and becoming more like Jesus. And why do I use this language of vulnerability to describe dying to self? And why do I think it's the ultimate end of human flourishing? Somebody I'm going to quote is a woman called Brené Brown. Some of you may have seen her videos on TED. She's a researcher in vulnerability. And this is what she has to say on the subject. Vulnerability is a collection of choices that we have to make every day. It's about the courage to be imperfect. It's about the choice to show up and be real, the choice to be honest, the choice to live and love wholeheartedly, even when it's hard, even when we're wrestling with the shame and fear of not being good enough. It is the choice to let our true selves be seen. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of hope, of empathy, accountability, and authenticity. If we want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper and more meaningful spiritual lives, vulnerability is the path. Jesus is calling us to a path to make ourselves completely vulnerable, to die to ourselves, to have the courage to be authentic, to be those generous people, those servant-hearted people that God made us to be, to flourish, to be our authentic selves, is to embrace vulnerability and to die to ourselves. While thinking about this talk, I was thinking about who are the people, who are the stories, who could I talk about that could help put a bit of a picture on this journey of going from a path of ultimately leads to death to a path that leads to life. And there were two people that came to mind who have been in the press recently, two contrasting, very contrasting stories. The first is a story of Joanne Dennehy. I think we have a slide for Joanne. On Friday, Joanne Dennehy was given a whole life sentence for triple murder, only the second woman, I believe, ever to have been given a whole life sentence. She killed three men. After killing her third victim, she phoned her friend and sang the Britney Spears song, "Oops, I Did It Again," down the line. Only she knows for sure why she embarked on a killing spree, but police believe the best explanation is simply she was having fun. Many have asked what went wrong. At first, Dennehy did well at Roundhouse Park School in Harpenden. Bright and capable, her parents hoped she would go on to university and become a lawyer, and even paid for extra tuition for her. She played for a school hockey team and netball team. It all began to go badly wrong in her mid-teens. She started skipping lessons and associating with a crowd of older boys. When she was about 15, she fell for a man called John, who was 5 years older than her, and ran away with him. Her family were frantic. The pair were eventually found living rough on a wasteland. They eventually managed to get her back and have reconciliation. But by this time, Dennehy had begun taking drugs and drinking, even turning up to school high on drugs. Age 16, she left home for good, only returning occasionally when she needed money. The doctors who examined Dennehy before and after her killing spree have diagnosed her with a range of conditions. A year before she was struck, she was found to have psychopathic antisocial personality disorder that manifested itself in anger, aggression, impulsivity, and irresponsibility. She did not care about the safety of others and felt no remorse when causing harm. When Dennehy appeared in the court heard that she had told a psychiatrist that she killed to see if she was cold as she thought she was, and she found that the spilling of blood became Moorish. I wanted to contrast that story with another woman who really has struck me in the press recently. The next woman is Alice Herz Sommer. Some of you may have heard of this woman. A documentary has recently been made and not Oscar nominated, The Lady in Number 6. She was the oldest known survivor of the Holocaust, and she recently died at the age of 110. The executive producer of the film, Frederick Bonholt, told Radio 4, "She is the most incredible person I've ever met. I think she had no material desires. She was very curious about everyone, and she had no hatred in her. She loved everyone in so many ways." Interviewed for the film, in which one of her neighbours describes the bliss of sharing the block of flats in North London and hearing classical music coming, being played beautifully every morning and afternoon, Herz Sommer described her life as full of joy. I think I'm in my last days, but it doesn't really matter because I've had such a beautiful life. And life is beautiful. Love is beautiful. Nature and music are beautiful. Everything we experience is a gift, a present we should cherish and pass on to those we love. The story of Herz Sommer was that she was born in 1903 in Prague into a prosperous, cultured and musical family. By her mid-teens, she herself was teaching and touring as a pianist. She married her musician husband, a fortnight after meeting him, and soon they had one son who also became a concert cellist. She recalled that the three were allowed to stay in their flat within a Nazi neighborhood, long after the Germans had invaded Czechoslovakia and most of the Jews of Prague had already been sent to the ghetto. Then in 1943, the inevitable order came. They were to be sent to a concentration camp. It was her summer's music that saved her. She became a member of a camp orchestra and played in more than 150 concerts, including special performances for the Red Cross inspectors. Her husband, though, died soon after being moved to Auschwitz in 1944. But her son, who also performed in children's opera, were among only 130 survivors of the 15,000 children who were sent to the camp. In an interview with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, when she was 106, she was full of joy and gratitude. These are the words that she said. "What have I learned at my advanced age is to be grateful that we have a nice life. There is electricity, there's cars, there's a telephone, there's internet. We also have hot water all day long. We live like kings. I've even got used to the bad weather in London." Now that's gratitude, getting used to the bad weather in London. Two women, two completely different stories, but they started off in very similar places at the beginning. There are two paths, there are two roads. One, that's, if we go on to the final slide, there are two paths, two roads. One that leads to life and one that leads to death. And the funny thing with those paths is at the beginning of our lives, they don't look that different. It doesn't look that bad to walk down the nice wide path that's going downhill. It feels very appealing. But the difference between the two paths is great. And as life goes on, we start to notice more and more the difference between those two paths. To truly flourish, to truly be all that we were made to be, we must make a choice. And the choice is to take that narrow path, the path of vulnerability. I'll finish with the words of Brené Brown again. "Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of hope, empathy, accountability, and authenticity. If we want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper and more meaningful spiritual lives, vulnerability is the path. And we don't have to walk it alone. We're not the first people to have ever walked that path. We have a God, Jesus, who came down. He came down. He incarnated himself. He came into this world. And he didn't choose the wide path. He chose the narrow path. Sometimes it just strikes me to think that the very night that Jesus knew he was going to be crucified, he went on his knees and he looked up and he prayed to his God and he said, "Father God, if you can, take this burden away from me, but not my will be done, but yours." That is an amazing example of making yourself vulnerable. And it's not for us to take the giant leap straight away. It's not for us to go from zero, from not even knowing God, not even being able to speak a little bit of truth or confess a small sin to go to that point. But that is the ultimate point we will get to. And it's not that even getting to that point is going to be something that we're going to hate. Actually, we're going to love that journey in a sense, because that is the point when you come to life. When something came into my heart and chipped away a little bit of that rock that was over my heart and let that little bit of light in, little did I know then that it would carry on doing that. Little did I know that path, which started off as a little divergent path from the wide road which leads to death, I didn't realize where it would start taking me. But it started to take me on that journey, and I pray that it carries on. But Jesus has shown us that way. And that journey we have a God who's there ahead of us, who wants to hold our hands and wants to say, "It is okay to be vulnerable. It is okay to be open. It's okay to accept your weaknesses, because it's exactly what I did. God, if it's in your power, take away this burden from me, but not my will be done, yours." And he accepted the call that was on his heart. He made himself vulnerable. And ultimately, that brought resurrection. It brought new life, and it brought life for us. This evening, I'll talk more about what we can do as a church community to reach out to others, but it all starts with the decision we have to make. My prayer is for all of us that we'd make that decision to choose that path of life. Amen.